You're listening to Audio Journal. Up next are articles and stories from Reader's Digest. This program is funded in part by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind. My name is Holly Miller, and I'm your volunteer reader. I'm recording this program today from my home in Burney, Texas. I was a volunteer for Audio Journal when I lived in Massachusetts. I've since moved back to my home state, but I'm thrilled that I can continue volunteering for Audio Journal by recording my program remotely. I'll begin my program today with inspiration. Words to live by. Poems offered me an anchor as I lost my son, so I shared them. By Josie Glasus, and this is from the Washington Post. In the early hours of March 23, 2023, about 12 hours before our treasured 12-year-old son died from a rare form of brain cancer, I climbed into his bed at Shaar Zedek Medical Center in Jerusalem, wrapped him in my arms, and recited the poem Jabberwocky. "'Twas brillig and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe." My child was no longer conscious, but I hoped and believed that he could sense my presence, and that my voice would comfort him and soothe his furiously beating heart. My son had learned the words to Lewis Carroll's nonsense poem by listening to me recite it to him and his twin sister at bedtime. A brave, bright, imaginative, optimistic boy. He loved the drama of the poem and the courage of the beamish boy, as with his vorpal sword in hand, he defeats his maxim foe. My son was also a passionate reader, but toward the end of a year punctured by surgeries, rounds of radiation, hospitalizations, and medication, it was harder for him to focus. Instead, I would sit beside his hospital bed and read aloud to him. Cargoes by John Masefield. Quinquereme of Nivea. From distant Ophir, rowing home to haven and sunny Palestine. And a Shakespeare sonnet, when in disgrace with fortune and men's eyes. He listened, rapt and smiling. Then we talked about the meaning of the poems. A few days later, I started my own poetry group on WhatsApp, calling it Poetry is Medicine, and inviting friends to join. I had found during earlier crisis that the rhythm of poetry can soothe my anxieties. With just a word or a phrase, a poem can reach the hidden places that prayer or well-meaning advice cannot. The poems offered an anchor to me during an unpredictable and painful time. In a calm interlude each day, I searched in my anthologies and on sites such as Poetry Daily for the right poem to share. The right poem could be about almost anything. An apple tree, an insect, a pie, a miracle. Some were classics. Everyone Sang by Siegfried Sassoon. A Modest Love by Sir Edward Dyer. The Lowest Trees Have Tops. An Ant, Her Gall. One, a psalm, The Lord to Me a Shepherd Is. Want therefore shall not I. People responded with heart emojis and their own favorites. My mother shared Shakespeare's soliloquies. We had to learn chunks by heart, she wrote. My sister and I exchanged messages about the poems of R.S. Thomas, which we had studied in school. All right, I was Welsh. Does it matter? Friends contributed. One sent Chinese Foot Chart by K. Ryan. Look. Boats of mercy embark from our heart of the oddest knock. Another carefully translated the Hebrew poem, Apple of Imperfection, by Varda Ginisar. First speech is the speech of love. Last speech, silence. The poems took on a life of their own. Friends shared them with their friends, saying that the verses added joy to their day. The poems that you send express in words feelings that I have no ability to express. My friend Marilyn wrote, one old school friend bought new collections telling me, it's been years, actually decades, since I've read poetry, but you've rekindled an interest. At 9:22 a.m. on March 23, 2023, I shared the poem Jabberwocky with my WhatsApp group. My son's heart stopped beating 3.5 hours later as I held his hand and sang to him. For our family, my husband, our daughter, his loss is a catastrophe. The space that our son had filled with his loving nature, his exuberance, his magical smile, his luminous observations, and his laughter was replaced by a gigantic empty hole. I stopped posting poems. Then my friend Layla sent me Late Fragment, Raymond Carver's last published poem. And what did you want? To call myself beloved, to feel myself beloved on the earth. In offering me some small comfort, because I knew that even in my son's darkest hours, he was always loved, and still is, and was never for a moment alone. I shared Late Fragment with my poetry group, and I began again to share poems and songs. One was Taking Care by Carlista Bation. I sit with my grief. I mother it. I hold its hand. Hot hand. I don't say shh. Another was Theme in Yellow. The title contains my son's favorite cheerful color by Carl Sandburg. When dusk is fallen, children join hands and circle around me, singing ghost songs. Friends posted yellow heart emojis. They added comments, quoted favorite lines. I felt loved and supported, and I was able to get up in the morning and take care of my daughter, who had lost her twin and only sibling from whom she'd never been apart. 7 weeks before my son died, we had celebrated our daughter's bat mitzvah. In synagogue, she read beautifully from the Torah portion of the Bishalach, in which the Israelites, fleeing slavery in Egypt, crossed the Red Sea on dry land, as the waters formed a wall for them on their right hand and on their left. Itself a beautiful poem. It reflected my feelings that our community had formed strong walls around us, supporting us at every step of our grueling journey. Perhaps that's why the poem that is most meaningful to me is Moesis, or Moses, by Luis Alberto de Quesina, translated from Spanish by Gustavo Perez Fermat. On the 8th day after my son died, I read it aloud beside his grave. Give me your hand. We have to cross the river, and my strength fails me. Hold me as if I were an abandoned package in a wicker basket, a lump that moves and cries in the twilight. Cross the river with me, even if this time the waters don't part before us, even if this time God doesn't come to our aid, and a flurry of arrows riddle our backs, even if there is no river. And here is Jabberwocky by Lewis Carroll. 'Twas brillig and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe. All mimsy were the borogoves and the mome raths outgrabe. Beware the Jabberwock, my son, the jaws that bite, the claws that catch. Beware the Jubjub bird and shun the frumious Bandersnatch. He took his vorpal sword in hand. Long time the maxim foe he sought. So rested by the tum-tum tree, and stood a while in thought. And as in uffish thought he stood, the Jabberwock with eyes of flame came whiffling through the tulgey wood, and burbled as it came. 1, 2, 1, 2, and through and through, the vorpal blade went snicker-snack. He left it dead, and with its head, he went galumphing back. And hast thou slain the Jabberwock? Come to my arms, my beamish boy. O frabjous-day, Callooh, Callay! He chortled in his joy. 'Twas brillig and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe. All mimsy were the borogoves and the mome raths outgrabe. Art of Living. Food, facts, and fun. Ooey gooey goodness. For flavor and fellowship, fondue is a slam dunk. by Emily Tyra. Some trends have their flash in the pan. Others are here to linger, like dear friends hovering over a fondue pot. At its essence, fondue is rich, nutty cheese. Gruyère and Emmental are classic, melted with white wine, thickened with cornstarch, and stirred until smooth. This irresistible mixture is served in an enamel pot that's kept warm over a small flame. A garlic clove is typically rubbed along the inside of the pot first to imbue all the ingredients to come. The white wine is essential, and not just for flavor, explains Daniel Gretzer, Senior Culinary Director of Serious Eats. Wine's natural acidity helps prevent cheese from clumping together when melted. His foolproof fondue is also spiked with lemon juice to help stabilize the emulsion while providing a bright foil to all that Swiss cheese. The classic communal meal, indeed, comes from Switzerland, where farm families wanted to stretch their resources during the winter. Just a nub of cheese, a splash of wine, a stale loaf and a warm hearth took that bread from day-old to delectable. Fondue stayed mostly a close-knit Alpine tradition until the 1930s. That's when the Swiss Cheese Union started campaigning for increased cheese consumption, promoting fondue as a patriotic symbol of Swiss unity. This so-called cheesemaker cartel had been calling the shots since its 1914 inception, setting the country's price for milk and limiting the production of milk and cheese, as well as the varieties that cheesemakers could produce. So in the 1930s, the Swiss Cheese Union made fondue the national cheese of Switzerland. But the experience was still largely unknown in America until 1964. That year, fondue debuted at the World's Fair in New York, where word got around to hit up the Swiss Pavilion's Alpine restaurant. Soon, swirling food on extra-long forks skyrocketed in popularity. The first melting pot restaurant opened in 1975 outside Orlando. But at-home enthusiasts also bubbled up as Americans took to transform their backyards into exotic escapes with luaus, tiki torches, and yes, fondue pots. In 2022, Food & Wine named cheese fondue among the biggest food trends since the magazine launched in 1978. But how does one do fondue? Dunking with bite-sized pieces of sturdy bread is certain. Cooked red skin potatoes, apples, or pear slices? Sure. Pickled accoutrements like cornicorns and pearl onions are intended as palate cleansers. To sip, white wine, cherry brandy, and hot tea. Lore has it that sipping something warm keeps the cheese from becoming a heavy lump in your stomach. According to Swiss tradition, the dipper who loses a piece of bread in the cheese buys a round of drinks, kisses neighbors at the table, or does the dishes. And don't neglect the last little bits of cheese caramelizing on the bottom of the pot, called La Rejolise, or the Nun, because it resembles the caps nuns wore in the Middle Ages. It's considered a delicacy and a privilege to eat. The RD List. What to read, watch, and listen to. In film, Arthur the King, starring Mark Wahlberg. Pause up for this movie, based on an incredible true story from 2014. Mark Wahlberg plays Michael Light, based on the real-life Michael Lenord, the captain of an adventure racing team, who feeds one of his meatballs to a stray dog, who is soon named Arthur the King. Improbably, the dog navigates the hundreds of miles of hiking, paddling, biking, and climbing alongside the team over the course of a 10-day race through the rainforest of the Dominican Republic. Both Light's team and the pooch are dismissed and counted out, but take turns saving one another from certain peril and encouraging one another to push on. Simu Liu plays Light's teammate and fellow adventurer. Bear Grylls plays himself in the big-screen adaptation of Lenore's 2017 book. In TV, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, starring Donald Glover and Maya Erskine. Yes, you read the title right. Mr. and Mrs. Smith, as an episodic reimagining of the iconic 2005 film of the same name, where Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie became Brangelina. In this series, funny people Donald Glover and Maya Erskine play John and Jane Smith. Glover also executive produces. A lot of people would say I'm just like Angelina Jolie and that we're really similar, Erskine joked with Entertainment Weekly. No, I'm kidding. I tend to play characters that feel like rejects of society, and my Jane felt like it was the reject version of Angelina Jolie. Unlike the original, in which the leads marry and then discover the other is a spy, this John and Jane know they're signing up for espionage. It's the marriage aspect that requires decoding. Streaming on Amazon Prime Video. In books, The Mystery Guest by Nita Prose. Nita Prose's debut novel, The Maid, introduced Molly Gray, a bright, awkward hotel maid with an impeccable memory. In The Mystery Guest, Prose returns with another murder mystery at the Regency Grand. A reclusive author, with a long shadow that stretches into Gray's past, has died minutes after being served tea by a new maid. These employees are the eyes and ears of a hotel. They're also the hands with access to means and room keys. But is the maid really the culprit? You don't have to read the first book to understand and get caught up in this clue-like page-turner sequel. Saving Michelangelo's Dome by Wayne Calasian. Stanford-trained engineer Wayne Calasian's fascinating account explains how modern engineering and architecture owes its foundation to an unexpected counterpart, religion. The dome in St. Peter's Basilica, designed by Michelangelo in the mid-1500s, became plagued by cracks. In 1742, Pope Benedict XIV employed three mathematicians to fix it. By the book's end, you'll wonder why Roger Joseph Boscovich, François Jacquier, and Thomas Le Sueur aren't household names alongside Michelangelo. And finally, Shades of Blue by James Kaplan. If you only own one jazz album, make it Miles Davis's Kind of Blue. If you only own one music history book, make it James Kaplan's Three Shades of Blue. The album set the standard for cool, and in its extraordinary book, Kaplan demonstrates how three core artists arrived at the legendary Kind of Blue session. Davis, the brash and driven trumpeter, John Coltrane, the spiritual and analytical saxophonist, and Bill Evans, the delicate and introspective pianist. Kaplan reveals the trio's creative origins and their awaiting destinies in a fast-changing post-war America. From RD.com, it's time to stop using your vintage Corel dinnerware. Here's Why by Emily Hanneman. If you have a set of Corel dishes from before 2005, then this is a must-read. Nearly all of us have a set of Corel dinnerware in the cupboard. It may have been purchased after a 70s kitchen update or kept on hand since the kids were born in the 80s. It is unbreakable, after all. Because of that decades-long connection, it feels like a member of the family. But the lengthy lifespan might also work against some of these pieces. Here's why you should use caution when eating off of older Corel dishes and how you can tell whether your dinnerware is safe. It's a problem with the paint. To understand why you might want to keep retro Corel in the cabinet, you have to understand the manufacturing process and how it's changed over the past several decades. Before the FDA placed regulations on how much lead could be used in tableware, plenty of companies used paints that contained lead in their products. These regulations came into effect only around 40 years ago, meaning that if you have a set of dishes made before 1980, there could be lead in the paint. If the paint leaches, or chips and flakes off, or mixes with your food, you might consume lead along with your meal. We don't have to tell you this, but lead can lead to some nasty side effects. It can be especially harmful to children, and there's really no safe level of the stuff you can put into your body either. So while dish-related lead poisoning isn't as serious as exposure to lead from house paint or water, Those gorgeous designs on your Corel could make you sick. In an email posted on Lead Safe Mama, Corel itself recommended that any dishes made prior to 2005 be used for decoration only. Corel products purchased after 2005 are safe and comply with FDA regulations. But if you have any older dishes, it's a little trickier. You'll want to avoid eating off an older Corel dinnerware if it shows obvious signs of deterioration. For example, if the glaze is worn or the paint is melting or chipping. To make sure you're not consuming lead, avoid eating hot foods on the dishes or drinking hot beverages from old cups. And don't put them in the microwave or store food in them for long periods of time. Lead Safe Mama tested a few Corel pieces. If none of those patterns look like yours and you're not sure when your set was made, use a lead test kit. Amazon offers several options, although it should be noted that test kits are more useful for detecting high levels of lead rather than trace amounts. In the end, if you're concerned, it's probably best to put the dishes in a display cabinet and replace them with newer, safer designs. Quotable quotes from Jennifer Garner, actor, and this is from Allure magazine. The more you engage, the more you learn about different ways that people believe and worship. The more you can sit next to anyone and be a neighbor. From Dan Pelosi, chef, and this is from The Healthy. The things that we experience when we're sitting at a table with people that we love are the things that keep us alive. From Misty Copeland, ballerina, and this is from Real Simple. It's important to know when to stop taking feedback to heart. There's more reward in taking a risk than in listening to naysayers who don't understand the mission. From Mike Tyson, boxer, and this is from GQ. There's nothing wrong with being afraid of somebody. Just never be intimidated. And finally, from Richard Ford, author, and this is from The Guardian. I don't read for comfort. Comfort I source elsewhere. I read only to learn something and be delighted by it. The Great Pushball Incident. These Navy boys go to great lengths to get their ball back. By Daniel V. Gallery, Rear Admiral, USN. Not long after I was sent to Iceland in December 1941, to command a U.S. Fleet air base that was to help the British Navy and Royal Air Force protect convoys, a shipment of recreational equipment arrived. Opening up the boxes like a bunch of kids on Christmas morning, we found, among other things, a push ball, which we promptly blew up to its full 5-foot diameter. Exploring the boxes for more loot, we left the push ball outside the gymnasium door unattended. You should never leave anything as big and as light as a push ball unattended in Iceland, because the wind comes along and blows it away. This happened to our push ball. I came out of the gym just in time to watch it bounce down the hill, over a bluff, and into the water. It sailed rapidly across the inlet and grounded on the opposite shore, where a British anti-aircraft battery had its camp. I wanted that push ball back, so I picked up my telephone to call the commanding officer of the British battery. Strange things often happen on our field telephone system, which is consistent of a labyrinth of wires laid out on the ground. This time, connections got crossed, and I heard my friend across the way calling British Admiralty headquarters. "The biggest bloody mine you've ever seen has just washed ashore," he was shouting. "Please send a bomb disposal party to deal with it." I hung up without saying a word and called Admiralty headquarters myself. I reported that we had seen a mine wash ashore, that we had a qualified bomb disposal squad, and if the Admiralty wished us to do so, we would be glad to deal with the situation. The Admiralty, of course, was delighted to have somebody take the nasty job off their hands. They promptly replied that this would be quite satisfactory. Rounding up about a dozen helpers, I explained the pitch. We organized a bomb disposal squad on the spot. We grabbed a portable field telephone set, a couple of voltmeters, a stethoscope, and some small toolboxes, and we jeeped over to the British camp. There we found our allies nervously eyeing the mine from a respectable distance. The arrival of our businesslike experts obviously relieved the tension. We had all read enough about bomb disposal to go through the proper motions. We immediately stationed sentries and pushed the crowd back to a safer distance. Then we placed one field telephone at the mine and the other 100 yards back, so that the mine disposal boys could phone back every move they made to be recorded in a notebook for the guidance of future mine disposal squads, in case this one made a wrong move and blew itself up. After a few minutes of hocus-pocus with the stethoscope and voltmeters, and much telephoning back and forth, we finally gave the signal that the big moment was at hand. As the crowd watched in awed silence, we unscrewed the valve, let the air out, and got the heck out of the camp as fast as we could. Needless to say, this incident helped us immeasurably in getting acquainted with the British. And here's some further humor in uniform from Christina Kostaka. On his first day of Army basic training, my husband stood with the other recruits as the sergeant asked, "How many of you are smokers?" Several men raised their hands. "Congratulations," he said. "You just quit." From Samuel Henry. During reservist training, my commanding officer was briefing his colleagues on the battalion's mission. While he was highlighting the key objectives of our task, serious business aimed at motivating the troops, he was suddenly interrupted by a ringing cell phone. The tune, Mission Impossible theme. From Edith Comito. When my husband visited our son Michael at boot camp, he found him marching smartly with his unit. He proudly approached the soldier and began to snap photo after photo. Embarrassed and worried about getting into trouble, Michael looked straight ahead and didn't change his expression. Suddenly, his drill sergeant barked, "Comito, give me 25 push-ups, and the next time your daddy wants your picture, you smile." From Gene Newman. It was our first day at the rifle range at Lackland Air Force Base. I felt confident as I aimed and squeezed the trigger of my carbine for the first shot. "Good news and bad news," my instructor said. "The good news, you got a bullseye." Before my head could swell too much, he added, "But it was somebody else's target." From Phyllis Nelson. Following a few frantic minutes, air traffic controllers finally made radio contact with the lost pilot. "What was your last known position?" they asked. "When I was number one for takeoff," came the reply. From Steve Finkelstein. It was basic training, and I was seated in the barber chair, bemoaning the impending loss of my hair. When the barber asked, "Where are you from?" "St. Louis," I grumbled. "Hey, I'm from St. Louis, too," he said. He then asked conspiratorially, "Do you want to keep your sideburns?" I perked up. "Sure." With that, he revved up the razor, clipped off my sideburns, and gave them to me. As I left the barber shop with sideburns in hand, I heard him ask his next victim, "Where are you from?" "Chicago." "Hey, I'm from Chicago, too." And finally from Brian Dean. Sign posted in the Army recruiting office. "Marry a veteran, girls. He can cook, make beds, and sew, and is already used to taking orders." Best pet pals. Ruby the pig from Newfoundland, New Jersey. I'd mentioned I wanted a pet pig to colleagues at the country club where I worked as a photographer. 6 years ago, the staff surprised me with a little Vietnamese pot-bellied pig. I knew right away that her name was Ruby. Everyone at the country club, staff and guests, loved Ruby, so I often brought her to work with me. She'd wander around the property grazing on the lawn, munching on the handouts people liked to feed her, and making surprise appearances at events. She seemed to like the attention and started wandering into photo shoots. Yes, photo bombing. Soon guests began asking that she join their photos. She was even featured in a bridal magazine. Ruby can sit, shake hands, kiss, nod, spin, and even open and close doors on command. But I never trained her to pose for photos. That came naturally. The veterinarian recently suggested that Ruby go on a diet, so she's on hiatus from the country club, where she's fed too many goodies. For now, as staycationed in her backyard and darling cottage is treating her kindly. And hopefully, soon, a newly svelte Ruby will be back. And this was nominated by Debbie Pagieri. Think your pet is the pick of the litter? See terms and submit your story at rd.com/petpals. Did you know that there are many ways to listen to audio journal broadcasts? You can listen to our live stream from your computer or tablet simply by going to our website at audiojournal.org. With a Wi-Fi connection, Audio Journal can also be accessed through your smart speaker. Simply say, Alexa, play radio station Audio Journal on TuneIn. Or, hey Google, play radio station Audio Journal on TuneIn. You can also listen using a landline phone. For phone access, call Zeno Media at 1-712-770-1043. We also provide special receivers tuned to Audio Journal's frequency. Need one? Give us a call at 508-797-1117 or email info@audiojournal.org for more information. You can also listen through local cable TV stations. Check our list to find your town by going to audiojournal.org/ways-2-listen. Oh no! Did you miss your favorite program? Not a problem. Look for archives on our website or the Audio Journal iPhone app at audiojournal.org/podcast-archive. Audio Journal is located at 799 West Boylston Street in Worcester. You can reach us at 508-797-1117 or at info@audiojournal.org. Nightmare Alley. A couple fleeing the shelling in Ukraine are captured by Russian troops. It's up to their frantic son, living 1,500 miles away, to get them free. By Reuben F. Johnson. And this is from Rolling Stone magazine. When Russian soldiers opened fire on our car, I thought we were dead. It was March 4th, 2022, 8 days into the invasion of Ukraine. My wife and I had hurriedly packed all our valuables that could fit in one suitcase and a couple of carry-ons. We hired a driver, thinking we could make it to the train station in Irpin, a village outside of Kiev that we had fled to after the war began. Nearly as soon as we pulled away from the rural farmhouse where we were staying, we ran into Russian armored vehicles. "Go back! Go back!" my wife screamed. The driver frantically tried to reverse. It was too late. Russian infantrymen began spraying our Toyota Camry with automatic weapons fire and chasing after us. After I ducked behind the driver's seat, I could hear the glass shattering into a million pieces as the bullets struck the windows. Somehow we managed to jump out of the moving car, hop over a fence, and take cover behind a bright blue porta-potty. Our bullet-ridden Camry careened down an incline and smashed into a fence. It was a complete wreck. "Come out from behind there," yelled a Russian soldier. We stepped out from our hiding place, hands raised, explaining we were unarmed civilians on our way to a train station. The Russian soldiers approached and pointed rifles in our face. The story of our capture started with a miscalculation. "There will not be a war," I heard the phrase over and over in Kiev. My wife, Irina Samsonenko, and I had been living in Ukraine for 21 years. I worked as a military affairs and Russian political analyst and as a consultant to the aerospace industry. Putin threatening Ukraine was a movie we had seen many times, and I assumed the saber rattling was just that and nothing more. Then the missile strikes began. Around 4 a.m, the air raid siren sounded, and we sought shelter in the underground garage across the street from where we lived in Kiev. When the shelling stopped later that day, we returned home. A few hours later, the bombardment began anew. We did not know what to do. Getting in our car and driving west, away from the Russians, was impossible. The roads were clogged with traffic for miles, and there was not a drop of gas to be had anywhere from Kiev to the Polish border. Anyone left in the city was now trapped there. Adding to the sense of helplessness was the odor of exploded ordnance permeating the air. This was not just a campaign against Ukraine's armed forces. This was a war to terrorize the civilian population. After spending two nights in air raid shelters, we decided to evacuate. We had friends about an hour outside the city, and they kindly agreed to let us stay in their guest house. Within 2 days of arriving, the fighting in and around nearby Gostomel Airport had shut down all utilities. The artillery and mortar duels between Ukrainian and Russian forces destroyed the water and power lines. Reaching their house was not so difficult, but now going back to Kiev was impossible. Every bridge between us and the city had blown up to stall the Russian advance. In our attempt to reach safety, we had become trapped. There was no exit from this place, as the entire area was now ringing with Russian troops and armor. During this time, our son Antonio Brasileiro Johnson, 18, was at his boarding school in Cambridge, England, monitoring the war 24/7. He spent long nights speaking with people in Ukraine, in some cases helping them find air raid shelters and ways to get out of battle zones. But he had only limited contact with us. No electricity except for about 3 hours a day from a gas generator meant smartphones were almost impossible to recharge. So Wednesday, March 2nd, was the last time we were able to talk to Antonio. The next day, I had expended most of the battery remaining on my MacBook Pro to compose an article on the war. Irina and I, our friends and their children, housekeeper and nanny, had to take shelter in their root cellar, while several Russian armored vehicles were stopped on the road outside the house. The Russians appeared to be lost in the maze of the country roads. They eventually moved on, but it was clearly no longer safe to stay here, so we made a break back to Kiev and fell into the hands of the Russian army. We watched in horror as the Russians looted our car, our belongings violently ransacked, and everything of value smashed or stolen. Irina had a hard drive full of nothing but family pictures and photos and videos of our son playing piano. It was among the many items stolen, a lifetime of memories gone in an instant. I noticed blood running down Irina's face. Flying fragments of glass from the shattered windows had lacerated her left cheek, and there were small grains of glass in her eye. Fortunately, a Russian combat medic was on the scene and treated her before the condition could become worse. All our computers and other hard drives were taken. All the work, every article I had written, every document I had ever saved, every photograph I had ever taken, were all gone. But the big bonanza for these war criminals was yet to come. As they tore into my computer bag, they found the portfolio where I was keeping the money we had saved for my son's education.
"Foreign currency,"
exclaimed one gleefully. This to them was the best payday they were ever going to see. The soldiers next began rifling through a pile of research materials I was using for some writing I was doing on the history of missile systems. Though none of the documents was classified, these dimwits were convinced they had stumbled across some top-level intelligence operative. The same soldier was so overjoyed at the prospect of stealing all our money that he put a grenade in the pocket of my coat and threatened to pull the pin if I did not tell him which secret agency I must be working for. Once they had finished stealing everything we owned, we were sent into a dark basement in a nearby building where numerous civilians were being held. Why these people had been detained was unclear, but I would be shocked if any of them were still alive today.
Groups of people who were held in this area ended up in mass graves. Next, we were packed into an armored vehicle. Two Ukrainian civilians with their hands tied behind their backs were thrown on top of our legs. We traveled this way for an hour and a half. While in transit, one of the Russian soldiers stole a gold ring that I had owned for 25 years. I'd planned to give it to Antonio once he graduated from college. At some point, we stopped in the middle of a forest. The two Ukrainians thrown on top of us were tossed out into the freezing cold mud. I never saw what happened to them, but I fear the worst. Irina and I were told to stand, not sit, in one place, with temperatures dropping precipitously. Were we going to be taken into the woods and shot? We stood this way for 2 hours, face to face, keeping our hands warm by holding on to each other. Some soldiers took pity on us and gave us half-full cups of hot tea. Finally, after some questioning about my papers, the soldiers left us in a van overnight with a box of the Russian equivalent of sea rations and some water. The driver came in periodically to run the engine for 10 minutes or so to warm up the interior and then shut it down again. We tried to sleep, but without knowing what the next day would bring, sleep was not possible. The next morning we were driven down roads strewn with burned-out military and civilian vehicles, the back of rockets protruding out of the ground, unexploded duds, and signs of explosions and devastation were everywhere. It was a journey through the landscape of hell. Then we saw our destination, Gostomel Airport. The runways were cratered and no longer serviceable, and the Russian army was using Gostomel as a command post of sorts. We were blindfolded and taken to an underground bunker, and when the blindfolds were removed, we were in a small room with a wooden desk, 3 cheap chairs, and nothing else. The floor was filthy, bare, cold, wet. There was no clock to tell the time, and no calendar to know the date. Irina began keeping track of the days, Alexandra Dumas, the Count of Monte Cristo style, by making 6 vertical lines and then a 7th horizontal line at an angle on the wall. How long we would be in this place was impossible to determine. No one told us why we were there or under what auspice we were held. No one in the outside world knew where we were, or if we were still alive. All we knew was that each morning when the radios and phones in the room across the corridor began ringing, it was the beginning of another day of war. Back in Cambridge, Antonio knew something was wrong. It was now Sunday, and he had not heard from us since Wednesday. He finally managed to get a call through to our friends whose place we had been staying at, and they told him the horrifying news which they'd learned from the driver we had hired. My son went straight to work trying to save us. Even at age 18, he knew how the U.S. government bureaucracy worked. His first call was to the American Embassy in London. Trying not to panic, he explained that he needed to come to the embassy to speak to someone about his parents. "Make an appointment," he was told. His next step was to call a friend of ours, retired U.S. Air Force Major General John Schopner, Jr. He is a fighter pilot who flew 154 combat missions over Vietnam and was the commander of Edwards Air Force Base. When Antonio relayed the situation, Schopner's general stars began flashing. He picked up the phone and called the American Embassy in London, in what I was told was an exercise in focusing their attention. His intervention worked. Within minutes, Antonio received a call back from someone further up the food chain in the London Embassy, who then relayed him to the American Embassy in Moscow. The State Department then put our situation in the hands of some very focused people. In the meantime, Schopner was on the phone to those he knew in the Pentagon, raising an equal level of attention with people there. After these initial interactions, Antonio was in contact with people from almost every government entity in the U.S., United Kingdom, and Ukraine that you could think of. In Kiev, they were beginning to put together a rescue plan that would involve Ukrainian special op troops storming the airport. But we knew none of this. To say Irina and I were in the information vacuum is being generous. All we knew was that there would be no quick end to this war. We were held in a windowless underground room, guarded by a soldier with an AK-47 cradled in his lap all hours of the day. There was no possibility of escape. Not even MacGyver could have found a way out. We slept on a flimsy wafer-thin mattress, large enough for only one person, and we had only a single blanket against the clammy cold of early March. My folded-up overcoat served as our pillow. Sanitary conditions were non-existent. I had to urinate into an empty plastic water bottle. Defecating was done in a bucket in the corner of the room, and thankfully had a lid to suppress the foul smell. We were provided Russian Army sea rations, but did not consume much. Living in this modern-day dungeon caused considerable stress. I suffer from hypertension, and could tell that my blood pressure was dangerously high. Our captors did everything they could to hide what was going on in the other sections of the bunker, but we could hear everything. The room next to ours was a medical triage unit. The sound of the maimed and dying still haunt me. Russian soldiers screamed from their wounds. Others, babbling incoherently, slipped in and out of consciousness, as morphine could only partially kill their pain. Then there was the sound of a big wide roll of packing tape being dispensed and wound around something. We knew what that sound was. Tape is used to bind the ankles of dead soldiers inside body bags. Every day we were under bombardment. The Ukrainian forces were never far away, and by conducting shoot-and-scoot harassment attacks against the airport, they made it impossible for the Russians to repair the runways. The building shook from the proximity of the sustained blasts. Even in the middle of the night, an artillery or mortar duel was not uncommon. We began to worry when the bombardments were accompanied by the sound of small arms fire, signs the fighting was almost on top of us. 8 days after we were captured, Antonia was contacted by a Ukrainian immigre colleague I knew in Kiev. She had been a translator and an analyst for high-level U.S. military officials interacting with Ukraine, and she had her own connections to the Pentagon. We still had no idea that any of this was taking place, but there were ultimately several people working on our release. One was Charlie Mount, who runs a catamaran charter cruise service in Florida. He met with one of his friends who phoned someone. He never told Charlie who it was, but when he put the phone down, he said, "Something is in motion. Don't ask me what, but things are happening." 2 days later, two soldiers appeared in our room and told us we were leaving. We were again blindfolded, then brought to the surface for the first time in 10 days. Supposedly, we were going to be taken from the airport to another location, but when we were halfway between the bunker and the truck to transport us, the airport was hit with a mortar attack. Our escort scampered for cover and left us in the open, blindfolded, exposed to furious shelling. How we managed to avoid being hit, I do not know, but when the firing subsided, our escort shoved us into a truck. We were taken to a nearby village and put into a small building being used by the Russians as a command post. Inside, they stuck us in a shower room with the shower heads removed, almost like the movies about Nazi death camps during World War II. We were fed a small hot meal, the first one in 2 weeks, and then told we had to sleep sitting up on the cold metal chairs. The next morning, March 15th, we were driven toward the north. The road was littered with cars shot to pieces. There were burned-out military vehicles, endless signs of explosions, and the track of heavy vehicles that had chewed up the road. Several hours later, we were dropped in the middle of nowhere. Our driver gave us back our passports and said, "Back the way you came is Ukraine, and that way is Belarus." Pointing toward Belarus, he said, "You should start walking." We could see nothing but empty fields and forests off to the distance. It was 5 p.m. and less than 2 hours from nightfall, so we started walking. We finally reached a Belarus border checkpoint and explained that we were refugees. They let us cross after a series of questions from their immigration, customs, and security personnel. Then came the greatest moment of our lives. A Red Cross worker had a tablet, and we were able to call Antonio on Telegram, an instant messaging app, and tell him we were alive. I was never so happy to hear my son's voice. The next day, we boarded a night train that took us to the Polish border in Brest. Several hours later, we were in Warsaw. First Arena, and then I, 7 days later, flew to the U.S. The following month, Antonio flew from London to join us. We were reunited. "Welcome home, Papa," he said as I hugged him, my body shaking with emotion. "I will always be here waiting for you." The rest stop road trip. As the saying goes, not one bladder empties, but another one fills. By Mary Roach. A family is a collection of people who share the same genes, but cannot agree on a place to pull over for lunch. Ed and I, plus his parents and sister Doris, and 8-year-old niece Alicia, are on a road trip to Yosemite. Poppy wants Subway, Ed wants In-N-Out Burger, and Mary wants Sonic. In the end, we compromise on McDonald's, where Alicia will get an action figure that will come in handy later for breaking the heater vent of our rented minivan. It's a 3-hour drive to Yosemite, but we're taking a little longer as we're working in a tour of Highway 80's public restrooms. As the saying goes, not one bladder empties, but another one fills. I'm reminded of that track and field event where one person runs for a while, then hands off the restroom key to the next person, who runs until she's done, and then another person runs. Unhappily, many of these restrooms belong to gas stations. Gas station customers, perhaps inspired by the nozzle on the pumps outside, are prone to dribble and slosh, though I almost prefer this to the high-tech humiliation of air travel, where the toilets flush mere seconds after you sit down. It's like having your plate cleared before you've even salted your potatoes. We get back on the road. Poppy's driving now. We've entered the road trip doldrums, the point when all the cheesy tabloids have been read. The travel Etch-A-Sketch has grown boring, and anyone under age 12 is required to say, "Are we there yet?" At ever-shortening intervals, Ed and his sister, two middle-aged adults, are playing with the highway bingo set. Alicia is making her action figure flight with Poppy's earlobes. Doris covers the bingo square that says motel. Bingo! "No way," says Ed. "A motel is only one story high and has a swimming pool full of algae. That was a hotel." "Same diff," says Doris. "Ma, Doris is cheating." Alicia kicks the back of Poppy's seat. "Are we there yet?" If by there she means the end of our rope, then yes, we are pulling in right now. Just outside Manteca, California, we stop for coffee. Coffee is an important feature of the restroom relay regime. Without it, the chain could be broken. The gold medal lost. At a Starbucks checkout, Ed buys a CD of Joni Mitchell's favorite musical picks. The hope is that it will have a calming effect. The first cut is by Duke Ellington. Alicia makes a face. "It's not my favorite Ellington number," agrees Nana. The CD returns to its case, pending the day Joni Mitchell joins us in our annual vacation. As we pull back onto the highway, it starts to pour, which at least quells the debate over whether to have the windows open. Depending on whom you ask, the temperature inside the minivan is either freezing or so hot I'm gonna suffocate. Then something amazing happens. As we climb the Sierras, the rain turns to snow. The pines are flecked with white. We are struck dumb by the scene outside. For a solid 15 minutes, everyone forgets about their bladder, their blood sugar, and the temperature in the van. Alicia has never seen snow, so we pull over to make snow angels and catch falling flakes on our tongues. Then Ed realizes we need tire chains, and we have to turn back and drive 30 miles to Oakhurst. "Good," says Poppy.
There's a very nice restroom there.
Laughter, the best medicine. From Marion Sparrer. During a visit to the ladies' room, my friend Addie heard the woman in the next stall suddenly ask, "So how are you?"
Startled, Addie replied tentatively, fine. The woman then continued,
"So what's new?"
Still confused, Addie said,
"Not much. What's new with you?" It was then that the woman snapped, "Do you mind? I'm on the phone." From Sarah Neville. Sitting at the kitchen table, I idly picked up a pack of cards and laid out a hand of solitaire, a game that I hadn't played in quite a while. My 10-year-old son came by and stopped to admire what I'd done. "Wow," Zachary said, "you know how to play that without a computer." From Norm Blimwall. Friends and I were chatting over dinner in a restaurant. A man at the next table told his cell phone caller to hold on. Then he stepped outside to talk. When he returned, I said, "That was very thoughtful."
"I had no choice," he said to me. "You were making too much noise." From Tom Sire, Ph.D. As a professor at Texas A&M, I taught during the day and did research at night. I would usually take a break around 9 p.m., calling up the strategy game Warcraft on the internet and played with an online team. One night I was paired with a veteran of the game, who was a master strategist. With him at the helm, our troops crushed opponent after opponent, and after 6 games we were undefeated. Suddenly, my fearless leader informed me his mom wanted him to go to bed. "How old are you?" I typed. 12, he replied. "How old are you?" Feeling my face redden, I answered, 8. From Mental Floss, Not Your Average Joe. The German everyman is named Otto Normal Verbraucher, which translates to Otto Normal Consumer. In France, he's called Monsieur Tout Le Monde, or Mr. Everybody. And in Finland, he's known as Matti Mikkelinen, meaning Matthew, one of us. From Simon Colland on X. I like having conversations with kids. Grown-ups never ask me what my third favorite reptile is. Well, that does it for our program today. You've been listening to articles and stories from Reader's Digest. This program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. This is Holly Miller, and I'll be with you again soon. Thanks for listening.
Audio Journal is supported in part by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind. We are a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
Welcome to Everyday Poems for Every Day, sponsored by Audio Journal. Our poem today is "Do Not Stand at My Grave and Weep," by Mary Elizabeth Fry. Do not stand at my grave and weep. I am not there. I do not sleep. I am a thousand winds that blow. I am the diamond glints on snow. I am the sun on ripened grain. I am the gentle autumn's rain. When you awaken in the morning's hush, I am the swift uplifting rush of quiet birds in circling flight. I am the stars that shine at night. Do not stand at my grave and cry. I am not there. I did not die. You've been listening to Everyday Poems for Every Day, sponsored by Audio Journal and read by me, Nikki Whichello. Thanks for listening. May your life be filled with the magic of poetry.
This is not a public service announcement. This is a one-minute mystery.
The only athletic sport Beulah Badinsky ever mastered was bingo. In fact, Beulah studiously avoided exercise at all costs. Considering the above facts, Beulah had a very strange habit. On Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, Beulah took the bus to the local bingo hall. The bus always makes two stops close to the hall. The first stop is 150 steps away, and the second stop is 300 steps away. Strangely enough, Beulah always gets out at the second stop and walks the 300 steps. What reason could she have for walking the extra distance?
Here's the solution to our mystery.
The bingo hall is on the side of a hill. Beulah prefers to walk 300 steps downhill to the hall rather than 150 steps uphill.
And now back to our regular programming.